By our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Sham Murad. Sham is an Iraqi academic and legal researcher based in Birmingham in the UK. She's a co-founder of the A is for Activism group, and she's been described as Baghdad's finest and Birmingham's own. Sham joins us today by Skype. Welcome to the show. Sham, let me start with you. You've said in the past that Palestine is not negotiable. I wonder if you could tell us what do you mean by that?
Thank you for having me on the show, Chris. One of the regular demands that we hear expressed by imperialist politicians and media is for Palestinians to sit at a table with Zionist colonizers and Western imperialists and negotiate away their land and their rights under the facade of a peace process. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we are rejecting the demand for them to engage in talks to carve out how much land that the Zionists are allowed to colonize and under what conditions Palestinians are allowed to live on their land. Palestinians have been clear since before the Nakba of 1948 that Palestine from the river to the sea belongs to the Palestinians and that they will not waver in their struggle for total liberation from colonialism and imperialism. No colonized people have acquired their land and freedom through negotiations with their colonizer. Palestinians have an inalienable right to fight for their land and for their freedom, a victory that will not happen through what Palestinian revolutionary Hassan Kanafani calls a conversation between the neck and the sword. For Kanafani, negotiations are not talks, but rather a form of capitulation. And that path is that one that the Palestinian masses reject en masse. Additionally, we also see this demand on the Western left for movements here to ignore the questions of colonialism and imperialism or to put these questions to the side. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we also mean we reject the idea that of the Western left that advances progressive values on many issues, but refuses to take a principled anti-imperialist position pertaining to the global South, and particularly with regards to Palestine. The sheer arrogant expectation that Palestinians should accept anything less than what they had before 1948 is not negotiable. So a mass workers and people's movement in the West must be willing to fight for the liberation of all peoples against imperialism. And that, of course, includes the Palestinian people.
Indeed. Well, thank you. I mean, David, tell us a bit about the other US corporations that are invested in the Zionist colonization of Palestine. And what about the British corporations today and, for that matter, in the past as well?
Well, I mean, one that comes to mind is Airbnb, which, of course, was pressured to remove its listings in the settlements and then reversed itself and allowed the listings. They're still listed. You can still go and live in illegal settlements with settlers. And it said, by way of compensation, that it would give the money that it made from these illegal settlements to humanitarian groups, which, of course, is a way around the fact that they're collaborating directly with the illegal settlements. In the UK, I mean, I suppose the most famous one is Marks and Spencer's, which, as we've heard in this programme before, set up a recruitment centre for the Haganah, the terrorist force which established the State of Israel back in 1947-48. And all the way through this process since 1948, Marks and Spencers, the families associated with Marks and Spencers, have been huge contributors to Zionism and indeed to activities in illegal settlements. So there's been those are two examples, but there are more where the business interests of Zionist leaders in this country and in the US have actually pumped millions of pounds into illegal activities in the settlements and indeed into ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Mm.
I mean, Sham, the previous report detailed significant corporate profiteering from Israeli prisons in Palestine. I mean, how do you think that connects to the struggles in countries like the US and Britain, where some of those corporations actually originate?
Yes, in Palestine, much like the US and Britain, prisons are used as a tool to repress colonized and exploited people. Leaders of anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements are incarcerated by a prison industrial complex that seeks not only to repress mass movements, but also exploit prisoners and profit off of incarceration. So we see the incarceration of revolutionary leaders like Moumaya Abu-Jamal in the US, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah in France, and Ahmed Sadat in Palestine by the Zionist entity. The law that political prisoners have all dared to break is the law of capitalism, colonialism and imperialism. We also see, much similarly, surveillance corporations reaping profits from the repression and incarceration of colonized peoples, and know that Israel, the US and other countries such as Canada and Britain exchange surveillance technology and policing tactics. This is seen through the collaboration between US police and Zionist military, the Canadian RCMP and the Zionist military units, and similarly the British police and the same training that they have received from Zionist military units. We know that a large amount of police and military technology that are used by British and American police are in prisons in the West, are tested on Palestinians by the Zionist entity. So it's important for us to continuously identify the relationship between the corporations and prisons and military, as these help us to then connect capitalism to imperialism and colonialism. We know that these are British corporations who benefit from prisons, both here and in places like Palestine. And it is pivotal for our activism here to be able to target these corporations that are complicit in the incarceration of colonized people fighting against imperialism and capitalism, including our comrades in Palestine.
Yes. I mean, David, I understand that HSBC previously divested from Israeli arms companies before, but how successful do you think have other pressure campaigns been in the past?
Well, I mean, these pressure campaigns can sometimes work, but it's not really very clear how effective they are and whether the results of the HSBC action did mean they had fully divested. So, you know, really the model we have to follow, I think, is the model pursued by Palestine Action, for example, in this country, of direct action. It's only through doing direct action like this that companies can be forced into facing the activities that they're complicit in and forced into actually withdrawing from them in a more sort of actually genuine way. So I think really that, you know, the lesson is that direct action is the way forward for these kinds of campaigns.
Yeah. Sham, tell us a bit about the relationship between neoliberalism and the privatisation of prisons.
Yes. In the 1980s, with the forced project of neoliberalism, which was spread both abroad through the imperialism like we saw in Chile and the unfortunate death of Salvador Allende, and at home through the state policies of key figures like Thatcher and Reagan, we saw the privatization of prisons, as well as the shifting of funds from welfare services towards the military and police. This era saw the expansion of prisons, huge increases in numbers of the people incarcerated, which were primarily poor and racialized people. We also saw, with the expansion of prisons is the expansion of prison labor and the privatization either of prisons themselves or elements of incarceration through public to private partnership. And it is through neoliberalism that the state offered new incentives for an increase in incarceration, meaning incarceration is not only as a tool for repression, but also as a tool for profit. As we saw, neoliberalism rolled back funding for things such as social housing and welfare. It rolled out funding for the punitive arms of the state, such as the police, who were tasked with incarcerating those in precarious positions who had now lost the limited social welfare that they had and housing that they had. Thus, neoliberalism, through the reallocation of funds, incentivized and allocated budgets towards punishing people and incarcerating those who had been made poor by capitalism. Interestingly enough, Frantz Fanon once wrote that in the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier who are the official instituted go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. And we see that through decades of industrialization, racial discrimination in housing and employment, and growing income inequality that have created pockets of intense poverty where jobs are scarce, public services are inadequate, and crime and violence are even more widespread. And even with the more intensive over-policing that we see today, people still feel unsafe, and young people continue to use violence as a predation and protection.
Indeed.
Any program
for... Yeah, you'll just need to just pause there for a moment, if we can, Sham. Thanks for that. Because we want to just have a look at this report on some of the cruel practices that are being used in Zionist prisons.
As we've seen, the Israeli prison system is a profit-churning factory of unfreedom for thousands of Palestinians. The profits are generated by Western and Israeli companies alike, but there's also a sophisticated system whereby the Israeli regime extracts profit from Palestinian prisoners by ensnaring them into debt for a myriad of whimsical reasons. Palestinian prisoners can be fined for missing the morning count, for returning their food plates to the jailers late. They can be fined to compensate for damage to property caused when Zionist guards beat them inside the jail. They can be fined for refusing to be strip searched or for protesting against the conditions within the facilities. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, in 2016 alone, it was found that overall fines of prisoners added up to an average of $500,000 per inmate. The Human Rights Watchdog commented that the imposition of financial fines on Palestinian prisoners has become a consistent approach adopted by the Israeli judiciary, where almost no sentence is passed without a fine. The next year, in 2017, found minors in Israeli prisons fined around $11,000 in 1 month alone. There are numerous examples, like the Alawi family in Nablus, who were forced to sell their home to pay off Israeli prison fines, with the threat of more jail time if the debt was not paid. There's also the case of Palestine's oldest female prisoner, Saadia Farajalla, who died just days after attending Israeli military court in a wheelchair and being told that she must pay 15,000 shekels worth of fines. The debt trap in Israeli prisons is real and a tool of economic warfare against Palestinians.
David, what about this despicable policy of using debt to ensnare Palestinian families while they're in prison? I mean, it's kind of beyond the pale. I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as you saw in the film there, the amount of money on average that young Palestinian prisoners are fined is about £125,000, right, in British money, that is. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the cost of two houses in the West Bank, on average. So that's a huge burden of debt which every Palestinian prisoner is saddled with, and of course their families have to pay. And so it's a way of really immiserating even further the occupied people in the West Bank. It's extraordinary.
You're not kidding. It really is. Sham, you're involved, aren't you, in Palestine Action, in that movement? And what just say a little bit about what the connection is between that activism and the plight of Palestinian prisoners.
Yes, Palestine Action is an incredible direct action organisation that has targeted Albert locations across the UK, aimed with shutting them down. Albert Systems is an Israeli arms company that tests its weapon on Palestinians and whose weapons have been used to repress, kill and incarcerate Palestinians. Albert Systems weapons have been directly used to facilitate Zionist raids, which have resulted in the arrest of the thousands of Palestinians. And it's the work of PalAction that they do in targeting these factories and directly challenging the ability of the Zionist state to arrest Palestinians. Additionally, a large portion of Albert's profits come from the Zionist military. Through shutting down their factories, PalAction is directly challenging the profits of Albert, which are directly extracting from the colonization and occupation of the Palestinian people. It's important to also note that this work challenges not only the repression of Palestinians, but of prisoners and colonized people around the world, as Albert has contracts and deals to sell weaponry to nations across the world, including the US and England. Thus, the work of PalAction also threatens the global imperialist alliance rather than just that in Israel alone, and the profiteering made by colonialism and capitalism, and directly threatens the repression of colonized and exploited people across the world by Albert's weaponry.
Yeah. I mean, David, what kind of pressure do you think could be applied on companies that are profiteering from the ethnic cleansing of Palestine?
Well, I think as we've heard, I mean, the kind of pressure that's needed is that people need to directly target these companies. Mm. They need to have direct action, they need to have protests outside on a repeat basis. And some of the tactics that have been used by Palestine Action have been extraordinary. They've had an alliance with the local community. They've had support from the local trade union movement, in particular the fire brigades union. Indeed. And they've also engaged in direct action where they've deliberately damaged the factories where these arms are made. And not one of them has been found guilty of any kind of crime as a result of this. And this is a model which we need to follow for, I think, many other companies which are engaged in these really inhumane and appalling acts in occupied Palestine.
Mm. Sham, I mean, companies like Volvo, Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, they're deeply invested in the infrastructure of the occupation, aren't they? I mean, what do you think can be done to challenge them?
Yeah, there's a number of ways we can challenge these companies. Firstly, boycotts, divestment and sanctions, the role of campaigns which directly tackle the ability of these companies to be profitable and forcing their hand to change. Secondly, through direct action campaigns, which can target the factories and businesses of these companies. We see how overwhelmingly successful it has been with Palestine Action. But also just last year, we saw South African dock workers refuse to unload Israeli ships in solidarity with Palestinians. And this is the kind of action that can be necessary to force change. And thirdly, I think it's quintessential to broader struggles that seek to challenge capitalism, imperialism and colonialism, and understand that the role that corporations have in the global imperialist system, and thus not expecting them to be part of the solution, but rather organizing broadly against capitalism and neoliberalism, and understand the role it plays in the repression of all people.
Yeah, I mean, you have got a book club, haven't you, in Birmingham, Sham? I mean, I just wondered if you could tell us a bit about how you've kind of brought in the issue of Palestine and neoliberalism into that space.
Yes, absolutely. The very first text we studied in 2017 was Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And there was many reasons for this. Part of it was to see how our struggles interlock with one another, because Angela Davis drew incredible distinctions between Palestine freedom movements and how they are crushed, and the Palestinian liberation and black liberation movements, especially in the context of Ferguson. And even more interestingly, as we studied this text many years ago, and we've seen G4S now have their hands forced, she drew comparisons on how G4S uses its company to maintain and reproduce the repressive apparatus in Palestine, be it their prisons or their checkpoints. But also she drew the comparisons on how G4S is also used to deport Mexican detainees in America, and also the what we had seen in the UK itself with Jimmy Mbenga's deportation, and it was G4S agents and guards that had killed him. So it's this idea that G4S represents this growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state, and ideologies of security that bolster not only the privatization of security and then privatization of imprisonment and then privatization of warfare, but just in general making it a more dangerous world for colonized and exploited people.
Yes. I mean, David, there's around 500 to 700 Palestinian kids imprisoned every single year, and mainly for things like stone throwing, and they can face sentences of up to 20 years. I mean, what kind of treatments are these Palestinian youngsters being subjected to in these dungeons, these Zionist prisons?
It won't surprise you to learn, Chris, that the treatment is not good. I mean, there's all sorts of mistreatment of prisoners, direct violence against them, torture, and all sorts of harassment of them, and the fine system where they're fined for doing things which they haven't themselves done. Yeah. So when they get beaten up, they get fined for that. But so the damage caused by the guards beating them up, they get fined for that. So there's all sorts of ways in which they are oppressed and repressed every day that they are in there. It's extraordinary, and hardly anyone hears about it. But you know, we've been able to talk about it today, and hopefully this is the beginning of people saying, "Look, this is not acceptable. This has to stop."
Well, I hope it certainly is a beginning, David, because, I mean, we've got a situation here where, you know, in South Africa, the apartheid system was held to account by the corporate media, but they are, the silence is deafening, it seems to me, when it comes to the abuses of these Zionist gangsters. But unfortunately, I can't ask for a response on that, David, because we are absolutely out of time, and so we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and thank you to Sham, obviously, for joining us via Skype, and thanks to David again. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Well, friends play an important role in everybody's life. But brother, you know, one aspect that teenagers are faced with is peer pressure from friends, which I guess comes from choosing the right friends. Could you shed some more light on this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So as you mentioned very rightly, that friends play a very important role in our lives.
Yeah.
And this is something that nobody can deny.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen this. And a lot of importance has been given to this topic in the discussion of psychology and sociology and youth studies generally. And you find that Islam has also given a lot of importance on this topic. And there's plenty of verses of the Holy Quran, as well as hadith from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wasalam, to discuss this very important topic and to advise us and to guide us into ensuring that this very important factor in our lives is a positive factor. It's a positive impact in our lives. And you find that the Holy Quran talks about this very clearly. So for example, to just give you a verse of the Quran before we begin, you have in Surah Furqan, verse 25, and the people of hell, for example, will complain, Ya waylata, laytani lam attakhid fulanan khalila. Or how I wish, it's a sense of very sense of deep regret.
Okay.
I wish, a regret that you can't go back and change anything now.
Mm-hmm.
You're faced with the consequence of what you did. And the blame comes on what? What is he blaming on? He says, Lam attakhid fulanan khalila. I wish I hadn't taken such a person as a friend.
Okay.
Right? And you find in other verses as well as in other riwayat as well, we have this, that the sadiq, the friend, the khalil, these people that are friends with me, are going to naturally have a very strong impact in me. In fact, you find, for example, in the discussion of spouse selection, that if you want to, if you're looking for a spouse, whether a boy is looking for a girl to get married to her, or a girl is looking to get married to a boy, one of the ways to find out more about this person is to find out who their friends are.
Mm.
Why? Because we're told, even in the hadith, we have this as well, that a person's religion is his friend's religion.
Okay.
Right? So
man is known by the company he keeps.
Exactly. That's another proverb as well that we have.
Yeah.
So we have this in hadith a lot, that if you want to know somebody, look at their friends. And so friends have a very big impact in our lives. And mm-hmm. therefore, what's very important for us is to make sure that we use this impact, this factor in our life in a positive way.
Okay.
And at this, on the other side as well, you'll find that many sad stories, many bad endings are due to friends. So with the verse we mentioned over here.
Yeah.
And you find as well when you talk to youth and you ask them, you ask them like the mistakes that they've done when they were teenagers, or the mistakes that they were involved in, that they will very often say, oh, it was because of this person. It was because of my friend. I wish if I hadn't listened to him, if I hadn't taken him as my friend, I would be a different person, or I would be doing things very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to realize this. And the key discussion, or one of the key discussions in this regard, is to talk about the choice that we have in making a rational choice in choosing our friends.
All right.
So let me share a few points. Let's take a break and then share a few points regarding this.
Yes, sure. Let's take a short break. We'll be back after a short break. Stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. Yes, brother, we're talking about friends.
So let me mention the Arabic of the hadith I pointed out before the break. So al-mar'u ala dini khalilih. A person is on the religion of his friend.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. Amir al-Mu'minin says that in a hadith, if a person is unknown to you, man ishtabaha alaykum amruhu walam ta'arifu, if you don't know somebody, if you don't know his amr, walam ta'arifu dinahu, fanzuru ila khulata'ihi, then look at the people around him.
All right.
So if there's somebody whom you don't know about, so mm-hmm. in spouse selection, for example, or in any setting, if you want to know somebody, find out whose friends are.
All right.
And experience has shown this as well. Many times I've tried this as well. I've seen it. If you want to know somebody, then you look at their friends. What's very important to realize, and just to take the discussion further as well, is that we have two types of people that we hang around with, or two types of friend. Let me share this hadith with you. Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam says, let me read the entire hadith. قَامَ رَجُلٌ بِالْبَصْرَةِ إِلَى أَمِيرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. A person from Basra comes. Mm-hmm. Look at what question he asks for Amir al-Mu'minin. He says, Ya Amir al-Mu'minin, أَخْبِرْنَا عَنِ الْإِخْوَانِ. Tell us about friendship. Tell us about brotherhood.
Okay.
فَقَالَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. Amir al-Mu'minin says, الْإِخْوَانِ صِنْفَانِ. The brotherhood or friends are of two types. إِخْوَانُ الثِّقَةِ وَإِخْوَانُ الْمُكَاشَرَةِ. You have the friends that are called the Ikhwan al-Thiqa. They are those reliable friends, those true friends, those close friends.
Mm-hmm.
In our own language, we count them as our best friends. Exactly. Wa Ikhwan al-Mukashara. These are friends of enjoyment, if you want to translate it literally. It means people that you hang around with, people you have fun with. But mm-hmm. they're not people that you would necessarily rely on, or you would trust them with anything.
Okay.
They're people that you, when you go out for a coffee, or you go play football, or you go to the cinema, you're together basically. You have fun together.
You hang around with them.
But when it comes for exam time, for example, when it comes to your parents did something to you and you've, You need a person to shoulder talk to.
Shoulder now.
A shoulder now. These are not the people that you go to, basically. You go to the first kind of people, the Ikhwan al-Thiqa. So Amir al-Mu'mineen very beautifully shows us that there's these two types of friends. So what's important for us is to realize the influence of these two types of friends.
Okay. Well, to know more on that, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. يا مقضي الخيرات
يا مقضي الخيرات. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it." يا مقضي الخيرات يا
مقضي الخيرات. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the role of friends in the teenager's life. Yes, brother, you share some beautiful verses, you share some beautiful hadith. What is more in the story?
When we talk about the influence of friends that we have, very interestingly, you find that both of these types of friends that I talked about, both of them have a very important influence on me. At what level, you would ask? I would say at multiple levels. The first level where friends have an influence is at the level of actions.
Okay.
You can imagine, I remember when I taught this in a class, I used this example. I think it went very well. It went down very well with the students and the youth. Imagine a bubble, right? An energy bubble.
Okay.
When you're with friends, what happens is that in that circle, a kind of energy bubble is created between the friends that are there in such a way that this leads to an action. And it's very difficult when you're within that circle to go against that energy. You're always stuck within that energy and you act based on that energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, for example, it's extremely difficult and it takes an extreme amount of power to tell your friend off when you're in that circle. So imagine the scene where you're all sitting together and you're having a laugh with 3, 4, 5 of your friends, basically. You've been there for a long time, for a few hours now. You're making loads of jokes and doing things together. And,
okay.
And suddenly a person passes in front of you and some of your friends laugh at him or her. Right? There's a very little chance that even though you know this is the wrong thing that just happened, right, that shouldn't have happened, but to stand against it is very difficult.
All right.
In fact, most people will actually do it and actually join in the mocking or making fun of a third person.
All right.
Why? Because it's part of that energy that's going around in the circle right now.
All right.
And so my actions are very much influenced by this group. When I come out of it, let's say at night, for example, imagine you see that person again that you're making fun of. You won't be making fun of that person anymore.
Yes.
You're actually speaking to him in a very respectful way.
Yes.
Right? And if you were to turn around and say, but this is not how you behaved with me this afternoon when we were passing around, you would tell him that that's because we were together with friends and it was a laugh, basically.
We were going with the flow.
Exactly. So you find that when you have a group of friends together, an energy is created that drives our actions.
Okay.
And it requires a lot to come out of it, not to be influenced by it. Even more energy to go against it and say, guys, please stop. What we're doing right now is not correct.
All right.
And so you find that friends influence our actions at a very high level. This was an example that happens at a physical level. Now, in the social media, it's the same thing as well. When you see social media people on Facebook together as friends or on Instagram or all the social medias that are out there, you find again that we're influenced and to go against that. Like, let's say all your friends have a particular type of photo, a profile photo of themselves.
All right.
For you to come out and put a black hijab, for example, a black scarf and a black hijab photo of yourself in a very modest way from very far, to stand out, this will be a very difficult task.
Okay.
And so you see how friends influence your actions.
All right. So sometimes we are driven by the things what our friends do. And you said that it's a lot of energy. And in order to come out of that and stand against that, what is not right morally, we need to have a lot of energy again. to stand out of that group. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on EnglishRadio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
October 22, 1969. We maintained the event of Karbala. Our preachers kept the event of Karbala alive. They kept alive the issue of the resistance of a small group, but with immense faith vis-à-vis the powerful but arrogant regime. Shedding tears for martyrs is tantamount to keeping the movement alive. It has been narrated that he who shed tears or makes others weep or even will be rewarded by admission to the paradise. This is because even he who simulates mourning and lamentation for the event of Karbala is helping to preserve the movement and uprising that was initiated by Imam al-Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Muharram and Ashura. In one of his speeches, he mentions that with the month of Muharram, the season of epic action, bravery and self-sacrifice begins. It is the month in which blood overwhelmed the sword, the power of truth forever condemned falsehood and stamped the oppressor's foreheads and evil government's face with the brand of falsehood. It is the month that taught future generations throughout history how to triumph over Bayonet Point, a month that recorded the defeat of the superpowers vis-a-vis the word of justice and truth. The month in which the Imam of the Muslims taught us the way to fight the tyrants of history. In this part of his speech, he has summarized the whole battle of Karbala in these sentences. The result of the battle, the movement that Imam Hussein had, he has summarized everything in it. And he said that for the generations, this is Imam Hussein who taught us how to fight against them. And Imam Hussein has become a mark, a slogan that tells us that whoever is with Hussein alayhi salam, he is with the truth. He is with the justice. And if you want to stand against the oppressors, what is the way of standing against them? How to raise your voice against them? And not to stop speaking or raising your voice against the oppression in the world. Wherever there is an oppression, you must stand against that oppression. This is what Imam Hussein has taught us. Imam Hussein has taught us, the month of Muharram teaches us, that how to raise against all kinds of oppressions, how to live with the justice, and how to battle with the superpowers. If you want to have the victory, it is necessary to follow the footsteps of Imam Hussein, to follow the footsteps of Imam Hussein, the guidance that were given by Imam Hussein, the criteria and the criteria which has been given by Imam Hussein, that is the actual thing. And this is the month of Muharram, because when the month of Muharram comes, people, they do protest on their votes against the oppressions.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the U.S. economy destroyed U.S. production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us, and we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It changes both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, and now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. This changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain their British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, in the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which were used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There were no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy. In Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations. And finally, the Soviet Union began to go down in technological competition. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arigi studies, each one century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new, more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production in the real sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the real sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which